Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Rory McGreal in this episode. Rory began with DOS-based dial-up networking in the 1980s, and since then his career has been based on an advocacy of online and open education. He has had both Commonwealth of Learning and ICDE chairs in open education, and is responsible for many world-leading developments in online learning practice. It's my pleasure to be talking with Professor Rory McGreal, Athabasca University Chairholder of the UNESCO International Council for Open and Distance Education Chair in Open Educational Resources, and a professor in the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences at Athabasca University. Rory has a long history in distance education that includes editorial responsibility for the International Review of Research in Open and Distributed Learning. Rory, thanks for making the time to talk.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Great. Rory, can we get underway with a brief overview of your career and publications?
I took distance education courses from McGill University in the early 70s, and I was an animateur for several courses at a distance when I worked in Schefferville in the late 70s, in way up in northern Quebec at the Labrador border. And these were courses from there. And then I took other courses from Télé-Université de Québec. And so I had experience as a student with distance education right up until before the 1980s. I had the opportunity to teach in the Seychelles Islands in the Indian Ocean in the early 80s. And when I was on a beach, I saw this magazine, the Times Man of the Year, the computer.
Yeah.
And I read that, and it had an enormous impression on me. I thought, yes, I've got to get into computing. I knew nothing about computing at that point. And so when I returned to Canada, I was accepted for my master's at Concordia University in Montreal in applied linguistics. But they also had a very strong technology component there, and I took a number of technology courses. And I also took some computer courses, again, from the Télé-Université de Québec. And that's how I got into computing. And I was on the internet back in 1982, 1983. And so I've been around for a long time using 360 baud modems, etc., and learning how to use the internet. I wrote a few programs. I wrote some exams on the Commodore 64. I did my thesis, my master's thesis, on the Commodore 64. And so I had a lot of early experience. After that, I went to Saudi Arabia, and in Saudi Arabia, I taught for 2 years, and I built a computer language lab in the university. I worked as a technology education teacher in Bahrain for 2 years before coming back to Canada. When back in Canada, I kept working on the internet, and I worked with Contact North in Northern Ontario, putting computer workstations for audiographic teleconferencing in over 100 schools. Again, I was on the internet at that time, but these were all done by regular telephone. But we did a lot of work on the internet, and I can remember bringing with me alligator clips to the motels, because I had to unscrew the telephone box and clip them to it in order to access the internet. That was many years ago. And from there I got a position as executive director of Teleeducation New Brunswick, a bilingual distance education network. And we set it up to be on the internet from the beginning. And there we trained people on how to use the internet. And we did it by basically asking people, what's your most interesting subject? And then we'd go with them and we'd show them on the internet all about how to find the information. And that's what stimulated people to use the internet. And I can remember I was at a conference in Montreal, I think about 1994, 95, just after Mozilla came out. And before that, we had worked on the World Wide Web in a DOS-based environment, so there were no graphics. And we, in fact, created what I believe was the world's first learning management system, and it was DOS-based. Even before Mozilla coming out, we had the first World Wide Web site for distance education. And so we were up to what was going on quite early. So anyway, to get back to that meeting in Montreal, two people went up talking before me about the internet, and they were showing the old DOS-based internet. And people were looking at it, and okay, that's interesting, whatever. And then I came on and started showing the graphics on the new Mozilla. And people just, wow, they woke up. They were amazed. Absolutely. Their amazement was fantastic to see. From there, I thought, you know, this is going to explode. Like people were getting interested in the internet. We had great difficulty getting them interested before that. And that's what did it, was the graphic interface on the internet. And it started booming. So we started creating courses and we built a repository, a metadata repository for online courses. And it was quite popular for people to find different courses at the time. And New Brunswick at that time, the premier was very supportive of technology and supported our network very strongly. And he was the first politician in Canada to get an email address in the early 90s. And he was very supportive of us. And in 1999, he quit, and a new premier came on. And the support for technology and for the distance ed started to collapse, which was a shame. But in a way, not, because so many people had learned how to use the internet at our sites and at other community sites that were built, that people were buying computers and using it from home. And at that time, New Brunswick had the fastest speeds on the internet in Canada. Because it was a small province, they just put fiber in a loop around the whole province. Mm-hmm. And so almost everywhere in the province had access to high-speed internet. But then started to work in creating courses with learning objects.
Yeah.
And from there, we developed metadata. And I moved to Athabasca because there was no more support for innovation in New Brunswick, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I moved to Athabasca University in Western Canada, in Alberta. From there, we started to support learning objects, and we came up with the CanCore Learning Object Metadata Standard, supporting interoperability. And it's during this phase with EduSource, was the name of the collaboration. It was a pan-Canadian collaboration about 10 different institutions. To create a repository, we realized that if content is restrictively licensed, it stops everything from happening. We can't share the information properly. It's too restrictive. And getting permissions was a very onerous process. And that's when we realized we've got to go to open licenses. Because if we don't, we can't really operate properly. And I believe that's the same to this day. I still believe that. You need to openly license content in order to make proper use of it in educational contexts.
Yeah.
Oh, at this time, also, I had a mini project with a colleague in Ireland who got money from Nokia for mobile learning. And at the time, I thought, this is just crazy. Mm-hmm. You can't learn anything using a mobile phone. Anyway, I had an invitation to the Philippines. And while there, I was driving through a small town with no electricity. And I saw a farmer in a field up to his knees in a rice paddy behind two oxen. And he was digital messaging. I slammed on the brakes because I couldn't believe what I saw. And because I realized that that phone had more computing power than the desktop computer I had 2 years earlier. That's when I realized, hey, this could work for education. Yeah. And I checked and I found out that at that time, the Philippines did more digital messaging per person than any other country in the world. I was quite surprised by that, and that Canada was so far behind. So returned to Canada, started getting interested in using mobile devices. I worked with my colleague Muhammad Ali and our librarians. We built the first mobile accessible library. Our university library became accessible on mobile devices at the very early stages. But we messed around with a lot of tablets between 2001 and 2005, and none of them were good enough to be used educationally until the iPad came out and the iPhone. And then we realized, wow, that's it. And of course, today, I think you'll find that more people are learning more things using their mobile devices than anyone would ever have predicted. We did that. Again, we found out that we had to openly license our content in order to make them usable on mobile devices because we had to alter the content to fit on the small screens. And you can't do that. It's against the law to do it with commercial content. So you have to have open content. So anyway, I was for 10 years the associate vice president research, and I promoted research in the university. And after 10 years, I left and was awarded a UNESCO Commonwealth of Learning chair in open educational resources. And for that, my responsibility was to promote open educational resources institutionally, nationally, and internationally, particularly with developing countries. So I got a grant from the provincial government and from the Hewlett Foundation to do this work. And since then, I've been promoting and supporting open educational resources in more than doing workshops, keynotes, training sessions in over 60 countries. And I continue to do that work. And I'm very supportive of open education initiatives everywhere.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about the OER work that you're doing?
Well, right now I'm working on assessment and accreditation, micro-credentials and badges, looking into blockchain applications for OER. And so that's what I'm focusing on now. But at the same time, I am still spending a lot of time visiting different institutions, either online visitations or in-person visitation. And for example, next month I shall be in Pakistan as a keynote at the Asian Association of Open Universities. And I'll be spending some time, I think, in Turkey. I've been invited for a keynote in November. And I'll be in Barcelona in Spain in December. So I'll be doing that work. This year I'm on sabbatical, so it's freed me up a lot more than I usually am. But I'm also the editor of EROTL, the International Review of Research in Open and Distributed Learning, supporting open access initiatives. And that is open access to scholarly articles. And as part of that research, I've been giving lectures on students how to publish in open access journals warning them of predatory journals and explaining how ranking is done, etc., things like that. It is a very full and fulfilling work. I believe that my work, along with collaborators and other people supporting open education resources, I know in our university we're talking about millions of dollars in savings. In the province, tens of millions of dollars in savings, real savings for students. And around the country, that's multiplied. And around the world, these OER initiatives are a huge source of savings. Not only that, they've supported real changes in pedagogy. You can use the open educational resources in many different ways, whereas you're strapped if you're using commercial content. It's basically supported radical pedagogical change for the better. So I am very pleased with the way things have gone. Of course, it never goes as fast as you'd like, but nevertheless, it's been a really a major change in the schools.
So, Rory, I'm sure some of the success of the Open Educational Resources has been the adoption of the CC BY. So you're not talking about share alike, you're not talking about no derivatives. Is that right? You've selected the most open license possible.
Yes, we have, although some would argue that the share alike is more open because it keeps it open. We agree with the recommendation of Creative Commons that the two open licenses are CC BY or CC BY SA, and that the no derivatives and the non-commercial are not open licenses. They're restrictive. And so we strongly recommend the use of either of those. We're not too bothered which of those people use, but we use just CC BY, and we haven't found any problems with it. But some people don't like the fact that commercial people can take over the stuff and make use of it and change it and then restrict it with because of the changes.
So, Rory, we're coming up towards the end of 2019. It sounds as though some really interesting things have been taking place in the online education world, particularly in the OER sense. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time?
My feeling is that online education has become established in the advanced countries. In the developing countries, they're still struggling. They don't have the bandwidth, and also they have that pre-colonial mentality of elitism in universities, and they want to go online in a very restrictive ways. We believe now is if you're not online, you're not getting a modern education. Some say, well, the future is going to be blended learning. And I think, yes, it will be for part of your learning. But there'll also be a lot of just online learning as well. It's going to be with badges and micro-credentialing. The way you get your education is not going to matter as much. And you'll be able to use your credentials in different ways and transfer them between different institutions. And I think that's the way of the future. So having that flexibility with micro-credentials, I think, is going to allow people to take their credentials anywhere. I know in Canada, it's a really big problem with immigrants who come in with recognized qualifications in their own country, but they're not recognized in Canada. And so we need to have the standardized credentials. We do a lot of that at the Basque University. We have a prior learning and assessment group, and you put in your credentials, what you have from abroad, what you've done in Canada, and we add it all up and we give people credit for that. And I think that that's going to be a big movement in education. And for me, my job is to promote open educational resources, not open practices.
Yeah.
If people want to use open practices, that's wonderful. If they want to use traditional methodologies, that's wonderful too, as long as they're using open educational resources. That's my focus. But many in the open education movement believe that you need OER is just a way of moving to this, what they consider to be open practices. And for me, I believe in OER because they allow the flexibility to do any form of teaching. If you want to do traditional lectures, you can do it with OER. If you want to use the behaviorist methodologies, you can do it with OER. If you want to be a connectivist, you can do it with OER. So I'm quite open and eclectic in that view, mainly because of I have never seen a teacher yet who's committed to one particular methodology, who only uses that methodology. Teachers are eclectic. Now, one of the things that's come to my attention more and more is a big problem in education is this learner-centered focus. And what I've noticed is we've been getting a lot of articles where they go on and on about the learner. They go on at how satisfied the learner is, how much the learner thinks that they've learned something, and they have no evidence that they actually have learned anything. They ask the student, do you feel you've learned something in this course? And they'll say yes, but there's no independent test to show that. So I've been refusing these articles because our journal is the International Review of Research in Open and Distributed Learning. And if there's nothing learned, if they're giving me research in pedagogy and it doesn't even mention the word learning, then it doesn't get into our journal.
Right.
And we've got a lot of articles like that where they say, oh, the students just loved it, great attitude, wonderfully interactive. And they never mention whether or not learning took place. And I do not agree with it at all. I believe in learning-centeredness. And you focus on the whole system, not just the learner. Of course the learner is included. But what about the needs of the instructor? What about the needs of the administration? What about the limitations of the technology in the schools? What about the parents' views? What are society's views? What are the employers' views? There's all kinds of input into the educational system. And to focus on the learner to the exclusion of everything else, to me, it doesn't make any sense. But it's grown. It's a big deal. Everyone talks about it. And my view is be learning-centered, not learner-centered.
So, Rory, if I was to give you an unlimited budget for you to do the research that you'd most like to see, what would you invest in? What sort of projects would you pick up?
So, I would strongly suggest two areas, assessment and accreditation, micro-credentials, badges, big area that we need. And the other one is the economics of education. Very little research on it. In fact, really good economics papers are often refused in educational publications because they feel that you should just focus on the pedagogy. Don't worry how much it costs. Well, no. Knowing how much it costs is really important. And reducing the cost per student is really important if we want to educate everybody and bring in mass education. I think another area is is on the MOOCs, which there is a lot of research going on now on the massive open online courses. Again, how cost effective are they or not? Or how can we make them more cost effective? I think that this is a neglected area in educational research.
Yeah, I think we used to have Greville Rumble, wasn't it, who did a lot of work on finance and economics in education, particularly distance education.
That's right, and Tony Bates, who's retired, he did a fair bit on it too. But it's not common, and it's sort of resented by people. I can remember being kicked out of faculties of education their talks because I mention cost effectiveness.
Mm.
They get very, very upset with that.
Rory, to finish, two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share.
Mpina Makoa in UNISA. Tel Amiel, his last name A-M-I-E-L, he's at the University of Brasilia. And I could also recommend Daniel Burgos at the University de La Rioja in Spain.
Fantastic.
They're good people, yep.
Well, Roy, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you for reaching back into the archives of memory there. There's been some wonderful depth to your interview and practice based on the first days with the Commodore 64 many years ago up to your current work with OER, and you're taking education forward in some wonderful ways. Thanks for talking.
Okay, thank you, and good to talk to you again, Mark, and thanks for this invitation to expound on my views.
You can learn more about Rory and his work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.